Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
What say you, Richard Ellett Murdoch? Are you guilty or not guilty of the felonies wherein you stand indicted?
Not guilty.
How shall you be tried?
By God and my country.
The exact time when Paul and Maggie Murdoch were murdered.
At the end of the investigation, it was obvious.
I'm not here to work with them, okay?
And the whole point is to have this not fall into the wrong hands. This case is unique, it's unprecedented in South Carolina history.
Welcome to Unsolved South Carolina, the Murdochs, Murders, Money, and Mystery. We are back with you. I'm Ann Emerson. I'm here with our exclusive legal analyst, Charlie Condon, also South Carolina's former general, as well as the executive producer here, Drew Tripp. We've got Max Harrison. We are at the ABC, WCIV studios here, Channel 4 studios in Charleston, filming this live for you. And Max is, again, doing all of the production work back there, along with his the photojournalist Sam Griswold, who was on location with us for 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
So now we're starting to be able to sift through not only all of your questions, which we have been seriously looking at and trying to, you know, kind of figure out what we can answer as part of it, but also just trying to take a minute and a breath to kind of figure out what just happened here. So I guess, Charlie, what just happened here? We just had 6 weeks in Walterboro with one of the most extraordinary trials of our lifetime.
Certainly.
Have you had a chance to start thinking about what you just saw?
Still need some more time to process, but I do think it was a watershed event for a number of different reasons, and I do think it's going to reverberate in South Carolina legal circles for decades, if not generations. I don't know where to start, but the background of the defendant, the how he got away with these financial crimes for so many years. How proudly, really, the folks in Walterboro and the sheriff's office, clerk of court, city of Walterboro, the jurors, the judge conducted themselves, the witnesses. It was, the advocates on both sides. It had everything, and I'm still not talking about all that it had, but evidentiary rulings on behalf of the judge that were extraordinary in lots of ways, had lots of legal implications. The one thing one of the prosecutors talked to me about, I don't think he would mind that I would be talking about it, but John Meadows talked about how the electronic evidence that was produced in this trial, that he would have gotten away with it as soon as, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago. Wow. But also how this might impact cases going forward, because you would have that CSI effect where jurors might now expect, well, it could be a run-of-the-mill B&E auto here in Charleston County. What's the OnStar data say? So that could have perhaps a negative effect, because to produce that kind of evidence takes time, money, and effort. So it could not be done, or will not be done in the routine case. But defense lawyers may be able to argue, where is it? They had that in the Murdaugh trial. So these sorts of things, I think, could have effects for generations.
Is there a way for us to find out how much this all cost? Like for the prosecution to put together?
That's a great case. I don't think, now, I think you told me, Drew, but, you know, we had the $600,000 that was taken from the retirement accounts of Alec Murdoch that, in other words, as I recall, the receivers got you know, typically you couldn't get retirement money because it's protected by federal law, but they made an agreement that you can keep X of this retirement money, we take the rest. Okay. And so you kept, I want to say, $600,000. So I'm assuming that was the beginning part of the defense
money. I was going to say, like, the first, like, experts and hours logged and billed and...
Yeah, we don't know. You know, it's a matter of privilege. I don't know if they want to disclose that. And who knows? It could have been, they could have taken it with the understanding that, hey, we would like to get further payment, but if you can't win it to the for the end. I often had that question asked of prosecuting cases on the state side. And hear me out on this because it's a little bit of a convoluted answer, but it's sort of like the military. You know, we have a military budget, and they're like fixed costs mm-hmm. out there. So if these jets weren't flying around Charleston, what would they otherwise be doing? You'd still would be spending the money. It's been appropriated. So I think to a large degree, you could say that the cost of prosecution has already been appropriated into the Attorney General's budget. It's rather a decision of how you allocate those resources. And we talk about that going forward. So they would have allocated, obviously, priority to this, but it had been in their budget to begin with. So they're not able, if they're in court in Walterboro, they're not prosecuting other people because they can't. They're you know, in Walterboro, but you probably could get a figure from them on what the experts cost and what the hard cost would be, which I think would be really a small percentage of the actual overall cost.
Well, and just the sweat equity.
Yes.
On something like this.
Yes.
The blood, sweat, and tears
yes.
that went into just
yes.
trying to
they
get through this
yeah, they
marathon.
They definitely put the effort in, I must say. We saw it firsthand with them going to court each day early and you could see that they thought about it over the weekend. They had planning sessions, and that's just what we saw for the 6 weeks. I'm certain that the months leading up to it, there were just hours and hours and hours of both police work, investigative work, and prosecution work. So it was, I thought, a very impressive performance by both sides, but particularly by the state of South Carolina. I thought they brought their A-plus game. We could always sort of critique and talk about, well, Creighton asked too many open-ended questions on cross-examination, but... If you sat there for 6 weeks, I just thought it was the majesty of the South Carolina legal system. Here you had a very prominent attorney that was sitting in the dock, so to speak. He was sitting there being prosecuted for double homicide. So mm-hmm. he was, you know, it was, I felt equal justice. You know, I've seen many folks sitting there that didn't have the resources that he had, but he was sitting there. He didn't get out of it. They were prosecuting for... And it wasn't an easy case. I mean, it was a circumstantial evidence case, not what I would call a slam dunk. So the state of South Carolina decided that they were going to go in there full bore, and they did. And it turned out the way, I think, if you saw the evidence, I think the, you know, truth has a way of sort of coming up from the ground in a courtroom. And I felt like as the weeks went on, the truth of the matter actually surfaced there. And it came to fruition in the unanimous verdict.
Drew. What have you had a chance to start kind of marinating over what we just went through?
My mind has more, I think, been preoccupied over what's next.
Me too.
And all the loose threads and different things that we've still got to get into with this case. And he's, as we've already talked a little bit about, Alex still facing 99 state. Mm-hmm. You know, state, it might even be more now with the tax evasion charges he got right before the trial. But
no,
all,
that was 99.
That
with
made
the
it
tax
99.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Okay. So all these financial crimes that we've got to get into and adjudicate, is he going to plea out on these? Is he going to go to trial? What's going to happen there? Then we have, of course, thinking about the appeal, and they have 10 days to file the mm-hmm. notice of the appeal, and then how long before we get the actual appeal, and what they're we mm-hmm. probably feel pretty confident what their appeal is going to say. And there's a roadmap here of, it's not clear yet, but it's years in the making of what we're probably still going to see with respect to Alec, and not just Alec. We still have the state prosecutions of Corey Fleming and Russell Lafitte. Just yesterday, we had Judge Richard Gergel, U.S. District Judge in federal court. He denied Russell Lafitte's attorney's request for an evidentiary hearing and on a retrial. and so was denied the retrial for Russell Lafitte after he was found guilty in November on all six charges related to bank and wire fraud conspiracy involving Alec Murdaugh, although Alec hasn't been charged in any federal case yet. He was heavily involved. I joked with John Monk from the state newspaper early in that trial. Alec wasn't on trial back in November, but you would have never known it from how often his name came up in it. That's where my head is going. However, we can't move on just yet from this one because there's still a lot of unanswered questions with the actual trial, which is part of what we're doing here today. And all those, you know, Easter eggs and teasers and, you know, things that like, they went nowhere. Like we got little tidbits and was there ever any resolution? And we're going to try and get to some of that today.
Great. Well, you know, I think that one of the things that I wanted to talk about, too, I was just listening to the ABC and the Today Show also had an opportunity to speak to some of the jurors. And we are certainly going to be going towards that same goal as well over the next weeks. One thing that I was hearing that I thought was so interesting was why they decided that Alec Murdaugh was guilty. And it sounds like he seriously created the most damage was through his own testimony. And of course, the lying with the kennel video is what I was hearing from just a small smattering of the jurors. We've only heard, I think we've only heard from four so far.
Yeah, and the crime scene visit, I think that
and the crime scene visit didn't do him any favors. And, of course, that was a defense's decision.
Yeah, they really wanted that one, didn't they? Having sat there for 6 weeks, I think the three things that you just mentioned, I did think there were seminal moments, and I thought they were very powerful. I don't know how you ever could get past that kennel video. And, of course, the way he tried to get past it almost made it worse, his explanation, didn't you think? It's like, well, I had this paranoid feeling.
I think that the jurors agreed with you.
Yeah, it was... And then when he testified, I thought he started off okay in the direct, and it looked like the first day of cross-examination didn't get to him. But I think by the second day, I think I may have sent a tweet out about this, that he had zero credibility. I mean, anything he said, you could just not count on. Because wow, the amount of times I heard that word lie, it had to be over, I think we talked about over 100 times, and he admitted he was a liar.
You know, we need to go in our court transcript. I think that we're going to be looking for the word stole. He stole it. Alec stole it.
Alec stole it.
Alec stole it. That was Jenny Sackinger stole it. Yeah, Alec stole it. And the lying, I think lie, you could probably find that word 10,000 times.
Yeah,
in this.
It was quite. It was very, very powerful, wasn't it?
And it was powerful enough to keep the jurors.
And I also thought, having been there too, I think the jurors may have seen this as well. He seemed like he was had a little vim and vigor to him on the first day. But by the end of it, was it 8 hours of cross-examination?
At least. I mean, I think we said that somewhere around 14 hours is, you know, the grand total of how long he was coming in and out and with breaks figured in.
Yeah, and I think the jurors kind of felt like his tears became crocodile tears, so to speak. And he looked different, didn't he? He looked very gaunt, and he looked sort of, hate to say it this way, but he looked like a murderer, possibly. He just looked had that not a good look after that. So
hardened.
Kind
of hardened. Well, Drew, do we have some questions?
Well, I'll get to the one we got. We'll start with the one we got the most, which is, did Alec actually have a $12 million life insurance policy or policies totaling $12 million, as was referenced by Dick Harpootlian and Jim Griffin in the initial SLED interview after the roadside shooting in September 2021? It was referenced in trial, but kind of left open-ended. And to that point, we aren't 100% sure. And now I'll say first, I've reached out to the Attorney General's office trying to ask that very question. And let me, you know, while we're sitting here, let me check my email to make sure I haven't gotten a response. I don't think I'm going to get a response on that. And here's why. The answer to that, I believe, would be relevant to the still pending charges and trial for the roadside shooting and the insurance fraud and all that. That's an open investigation. I doubt we're going to get any official sources commenting on that to tell us whether he actually did. And that could all come out in trial or come out further pretrial motions thing and responses to motions the way it did with this trial. However, I did reach out to an attorney who would know or would be more in the know than Joe Blow off the street. That would be Mark Tinsley. And asked him that today. It's like, hey, did you know, in the discovery process, everything that was ever turned over to you or that you saw or you heard about, did you ever find any record of $12 million in life insurance? And he did not. That was Mark Tinsley's answer. Not to his knowledge, there was not $12 million in life insurance. So, and we'd been told before trial that there were not any life insurance policies on Maggie or Paul specifically. So this leads into a lot of like spider web, like a window piece of glass shattering, and all the spider webbing and all the little rivulets and things that branch out, and where you could go with that question. One being, well, what then? One that I saw posed, I think relevant to that, would be the estate of Alec's father, Randolph III. And if Alec knew or had a pretty good idea that, and this had occurred to me before, which, and again, I don't want to speculate here. I'm not a criminal. I don't know how to think like a criminal. Just at least, not that I'm not that you all are aware of. Yeah. At least, anyway, jokes aside, if Alec knew he knew that his father was dying, and that is going to dry up at least one of his funding sources, because he was able to still go borrow money from his dad. Right? He knew that his dad was about to die and he wouldn't be able to access that money by any means, at least for a year, to the probate process. What if that was one of the catalysts to, as the jury has decided and found him guilty of, what if that was one of the catalysts to murder Maggie and Paul? At the same time, dad's about to die. If I go ahead and do this now, I'll be all set in about a year to get all this money, and I can keep, you know, kicking the can. And that kind of fits with the state's motive, kicking the can down the road.
I thought about this might fit into what you're talking about, because if Maggie and Paul are dead, I don't know if they had wills or whether they were intestate, he would stand to inherit from them.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, I think most states have similar laws. There's a state statute that says if you murder the person, you can't inherit their money.
Right.
So he had more riding on the case than maybe just the... because I do think the financial crimes are such where the likelihood of him spending the rest of his life in prison is high anyway.
Right.
So that may argue as to why he went to the mat, so to speak, on these murder charges and didn't seek a universal resolution of everything, including maybe... You know, he could have pled guilty. There's a case called Alford versus North Carolina where the U.S. Supreme Court decided this was a capital case, but it's used routinely in criminal court. You can go into court and say, I'm innocent. I didn't do this. But the evidence is so overwhelming, I'm going to plead guilty to it. And the judge can accept that plea. So that was another possible way to resolve this and still save face with his family. Didn't do any of that. So that, you know, I think it's appropriate commentary to think about these monies flowing through from his father and then from Maggie and Paul. And I don't know what, as I said, the size of their estates are going to be, but there will be certainly something to that.
Well, sure. I mean, and, you know, the estates now, all of this money, what's the situation right now? It's all frozen. All assets are frozen as of right now. There is no money to be had, even for Buster.
Well, I think that part has been resolved with Buster.
Mm-hmm.
I think he may still be under the receivership. I don't. Mm-hmm.
It was a half million, wasn't it? That he got.
I think he was able to walk with a half a million.
Mm-hmm. Right, which is.
But during the whole last couple of years,
yes.
Or last year, I would say last year, that money's been frozen.
So he hasn't actually gotten it.
I think he should be getting it now. But that was to be able to get away.
Legal fee out of that, or do we know if there's a legal fee due?
That's a great question.
So he may not net the full half million, but
Right.
But, you know, aren't there a lot of questions here as we go forward?
There's so many questions.
And I do think the big policy question with the Attorney General of South Carolina is, do you prosecute the remaining cases fully? You pick and choose some, or do you do none of them and wait for the appeals to occur? So we'll see what happens. I would think from a policy standpoint, he would want to take into account the cost of prosecution. But also, I mean, some of those cases is that, like the Tony Satterfield case, mm-hmm. really, when you hear the, wow, when you hear what happened to him.
Well, and you know, we did have a chance to, or I had a chance to have a brief conversation with Eric Bland today, mm-hmm. who is representing mm-hmm. Tony and his brother Brian in the Satterfield case, and I'm going to be speaking with him tomorrow mm-hmm. More about what is to come. But they absolutely, and that's what I wanted to ask you about, Charlie, is it sounds like they do want to file, they do want to go forward with this case, with the Satterfield.
The criminal case.
I think for Eric Bland as a civil attorney, I think he's going to be looking at the civil case as well. So I'm just trying to understand
what they can
start moving on now. Does getting this murder conviction give the other attorneys that are sort of lining up for either civil cases, does this give them more of an opportunity to move forward with their cases?
Yeah, it really should, because he, under oath, he admitted to lots of financial misdeeds, so you have that. And, of course, he would have complete control of the civil, how he handles that. The Attorney General would have complete control on the prosecution of other cases. He does have to, I know a lot about this, because when I ran for Attorney General, part of my platform was to have a victim's bill of rights in the state constitution. It's there. So he does have to, it passed. It's not easy to amend our state constitution, but we did it. So he does have to get input from the victims. He doesn't have to do what they say, but he has to get input. And it sounds like the clear input is going to be, we would like you to prosecute this case fully, which I think is a fair request given the gravity of the crime, even though, you know, he's locked up presumably for life if these appeals hold up. So you can't serve more than your natural life, but that appeal won't be decided for a year, and evidence does get out, you know, does fade, although I think the evidence in that's going to stay pretty strong. But do you want to use some resources? The trial won't be 6 weeks. It'll be more like 3 days.
Okay.
So that does, I would think, argue for going forward on at least some of them.
Well, and I think A.G. Wilson actually tweeted out recently that he wanted us to continue to remember the victims in this, and that there are more victims that need justice.
That was today, actually.
That was today.
Makes perfect sense.
So that could be mm-hmm. foreshadowing sort of what we're going to see from the AG's mm-hmm. office, that they're not ready to...
I don't blame him for that. If he wants to, you know, there are two or three that really stuck out in my mind as to, wow, how could you do this to somebody? And he did. Alex admitted to it, so we're not speculating here. And if you want to hold him accountable for that, there's a way to do that with criminal court and to get further sentences on him. I think that may be an appropriate use of resource, even though you've got somebody who looks like, I think the appeal, I mean, there are issues there, but I think there's a harmless error analysis that could apply. But, you know, it's possible it could be reversed. He'll be facing another prosecution, I'm confident. So how do you want to allocate your resources? But again, Creighton knows this case so well. I don't think the preparation time would be that much. And so you're looking at a case that would be held certainly within a week. So it might make some sense to do one or two of them and, you know, get those convictions and have those in the appellate system. Would make sense.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Well, we just got some information through that Dick Harpootlian, Senator Harpootlian at the moment, has been making some comments about how he says that Newman, from what we're reading, that Newman made possibly some legal errors, which is part of the reason they plan to appeal. What do you think about that?
Well, they've been really clear on that they feel like the financial crime motive evidence shouldn't be admissible. But I did, I mean, as you sat there through 6 weeks of it, I remember there were a couple of times, remember one time he excluded evidence, and then wasn't 2 hours later, they went right into it on cross-examination, and the judge, I forget what the, how he said it, but it was very, very touching language, very good language, about building a bridge over to where...
And then the road, and then you just built a road to go over the bridge,
right over the bridge
to keep on going.
Yeah, and I told you, you know, I allowed you not to go across it. So I think the way that's going to play out on appeal, that's going to be their main issue. The appellate, another interesting sort of fact on this is, you know, typically in South Carolina, the prosecutions the cases are prosecuted by the local circuit solicitor. And the appeals are handled by the Attorney General's office. Well, here you get the cases prosecuted by the Attorney General's office, and the appellate division will handle the appeal. And so they can just walk right down the hallway, like, what happened in court, and have people right there to tell them, which is very unusual. Don Zelicka used to handle my capital appeals, and you know, he'd read the record, but he would talk sometimes. He'd have some questions. Well, this is an easy one. They're all right there. Don's right there. And so I do think the argument's going to go something like this. And there'll be briefings on both sides, but the briefing will be horrible, what Judge Newman did. This is inflammatory. It wasn't allowed. And their counter brief's going to be, it is allowed. It's proper to prove motive. He instructed the jury at least 3 to 4 times, I think. They only considered it for that. And none of these jurors, by the way, and for what it's worth department, this typically isn't allowed on as part of the record. But jurors, when they're talking about it, they aren't saying we were so inflamed by the financial crimes that we convicted them. They're talking about the actual evidence of the murders, aren't they, and the reasons for a conviction. So on the face of it, they did follow the instructions. But having said all that, I'm confident AG's office is going to say, even if he did make an error, it's harmless error given the weight of the evidence against him and also the fact that the defense themselves went down these roads in their cross-examinations and their questioning. And so we would ask that it be affirmed on appeal. 5 justices on the Supreme Court, takes 3 to affirm it. And we should know, I would think this case, I would think they'd give it a little bit of a priority. They never tell you their scheduling, but I would think we would hear with a year to a year and a half on this as their decision. In the meantime, he'll be... And this will be interesting to watch, too. He went through reception evaluation at Kirkland. The Department of Corrections says they're going to follow their guidelines and assign him to a maximum security prison. But I still have to think Director Sterling is going to be looking at the safety issue for him. I would think that would be something that... So he may be in one of these maximum security prisons, but the sub-topic here might be, okay, he's in there, but do you have him in a special cell? So I would think they would say that if they're going to do that, because I think given the nature of the defendant, the high profile here in the crimes and the financial crimes, I just think he's at risk, personally.
Yeah, and we can't discount the fact that we've heard the names of some street gangs thrown out there at different points. Different points during all this. So.
And Eddie Smith's kind of faded away, hasn't he? He's gotten a couple of interviews that didn't seem to be that credible, right? But he's faded away in this case, hasn't he?
Yeah, absolutely.
To Dick Harpootlian's point, where in trial he said he was essentially salivating over the chance to get Eddie Smith on the witness stand, right, and said he's told no less than 6 stories. He got in an interview with ABC 2020 just a couple weeks ago, and they've aired it already, I believe. Eddie said he told another story, told a totally new story, different again about what happened with the roadside shooting,
not credible,
not at all,
mm-hmm.
not at all. Mm-hmm. Switching gears a little bit, let's get back to answering some questions. One of the main ones we've gotten more about these loose threads or dead ends that kind of went nowhere. I think one would certainly be the Gucci receipt, which has been somewhat of a comical point.
Tell them what the Gucci receipt is.
Remember the day after the murders, when SLED was searching the property there at the Murdoch's home in the Moselle area, they found in the trash can some empty cartridge boxes, some rifle cartridge boxes, and they found a shredded up receipt. And on the receipt, I think it was a credit card statement, on that receipt was a circled entry for a purchase at the Gucci store in Charleston. Mm-hmm. And they made sure to mention it at the time. And like they were somewhat making a point out of what we were seeing in there. And they just never followed up on it. But I guess we'll never know until, you know, we keep who knows? Maybe we'll find out something on that later. Another one that a lot of people want to know about that we didn't ever get any real resolution on. I get maybe we did, but didn't, which would speak to the defense's case, was I believe it was Detective Laura Rutland for the Colleton County Sheriff's Office testified when she was observing Maggie Murdoch's body. She noticed some hairs in Maggie's
her hand.
On her hand or in her hand. And I think they also noted other people who reviewed the crime scene and reviewed autopsy photos noticed there was also hair on other parts of her body. And that was suggested that could have been from her
wounds.
Yeah,
weren't you kind of surprised her crime scene expert didn't get into that? I think it's just, just
can
reprehensible they didn't.
You go ahead. I had a speculation on this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm speculating. But she had just been messing with the dogs for a while,
right.
Grabbing the dogs, trying to get a chicken out of the dog's mouth, helping with all of this. This happened, we know now, within minutes. And these are dogs that shed all over the place. Like when I grab my dog.
Oh, you think it's dog hair?
I don't know. They never said if it was a human hair or dog hair.
Yeah.
And then it just went away.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be ridiculous, but so was the idea that there's a clump full of somebody's human hair.
I just thought the hair remember the DNA in her fingernails? I just thought I'd hear a lot of the combination. Why didn't they exclude? I don't know. I just thought that was a pretty good issue. I didn't hear the crime scene person get on that very much.
Yeah.
That's why I'm speculating.
We don't know the answer. We're in the same boat as all of you listening and watching it with that. They, for all we know, I don't believe they tested it. That's back to the defense's theory, and they tried to put Sled on trial and for their alleged failures.
And wasn't that interesting how Chief Keel handled all that? I thought with his press, he took no questions, and it was sort of a victory lap, wouldn't you say, press conference?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And he wanted to kind of back up his, and they're all standing up there, but no questions.
Yeah.
And I know what you would have asked him. And,
mm-hmm.
And have you learned for this? Are you making changes? And I got to think that they did learn and they are making changes, but he didn't want to talk. He didn't offer a chance to talk about that.
I mean, there is just a huge hole in this investigation with that T-shirt. With the blood spatter evidance.
Yeah, you were on that early. I remember you asked me about that months ago. And I frankly, as the trial progressed, I was really surprised how that was missed by the state so badly.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't blood spatter on there.
And because there wasn't blood found on there.
Yeah, it was probably fish blood, right, as experts said. And then the fact that actually, I thought, made the case stronger that they were going with the, as Attorney Griffin called it, the clean shirt theory, that you put on clean clothes and got rid of the blood spattered clothes. That made more sense to me time-wise anyway. But they went down that path, I guess, for months and months, right? Mm-hmm. Wrongly.
Until they unlocked Paul's phone.
Well, and then they destroyed the T-shirt with the LCV.
Yeah, by examining
The leukocrystal violet substance.
Yeah.
So that this was what concerned me the most, honestly, and we just haven't had a chance to talk about it. But the fact that and tell me if I'm wrong, but that meant that the defense could not examine that T-shirt because it was destroyed, or quote unquote destroyed, by the work that was done in the Sled Crime Lab. And I don't, I don't understand why that just got.
Yeah, that's a good point. They could have made a big deal about having destroyed it by chasing the wrong theory. Proven to be wrong, that they then didn't allow the defense to examine it to help find the real killer. That's not bad.
Why didn't the defense bring that into, they could have brought that into as an exhibit, right?
Yeah, again, that was, again,
I would have brought that in.
Yeah, it's easy to second guess these things.
Right, I was going to say.
Would you say this is fair? I think they're terrific attorney. I didn't have a theme of defense, right? It was more like the day, let's jump on this, and then the next two or three days it kind of changed a little bit. It didn't seem like an overarching theme. Did you catch one from the defense?
Just a square peg in a round hole.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to keep on keeping this guy in the circle. We don't have anybody else.
Yeah.
It's always the dad that did it.
Yeah.
So we're going to stick with that story and we're going to make it work.
Right.
That was the theme that I heard.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think Max has a question. Max, do you have a question for us?
Yeah. Some people recently saw that Randy Murtaugh has done an interview. What are your thoughts on that?
So I can speak to this one just a little bit in case
you haven't
seen it. Randy Murtaugh has spoken to a reporter from the New York Times, Nick Bogleburrows. He was the Southeastern region reporter for the New York Times.
Right? How do you pronounce his last name?
Bogleburrows. It's a hyphenated last name. Nick was here throughout the trial covering
it. He was embedded,
along with all of us, and he had the from our standpoint, he had as far as people who we'd all like to talk to, he had the good fortune to speak to Randy Murtaugh, and he went out to Randy's place and spent the afternoon with him and spoke to him, and it was in stark contrast to what somewhat the portrait painted by the defense after the verdict and the sentencing on Friday. And the family now believes more than ever that he's innocent, and this has proven. Well, if you read what Nick wrote, that's not so much the case.
From Randy.
Yeah. And I'll pull a quote here. Again, I don't want to try and give away this whole story, but just reading off my computer, Randy, according to Nick, said he knows more than what he's saying. This is Randy Murtaugh speaking. He's not telling the truth, in my opinion, about everything there. And that's with respect to the murders. And that's his own brother saying this. Also learned from this interview with the Times that Randy says he hasn't spoken to Alec more than a year. And I think it was notable in the jailhouse phone calls. You remember this, it seems like a lifetime ago, but about this time a year ago, February and March of 2022, is when we were all FOIAing Fitz News and the Murdoch Murders podcast had gotten the initial round of jailhouse phone calls, and we all said, you know what, we're going to do that too, and we got a few more, and everybody else started FOIAing those, and that led to federal court loss, files for injunction, all this stuff. But some of those did end up getting released, and in those jailhouse calls, you never heard Randy. Or John Marvin, Liz, Lynn, Buster.
You didn't hear Randy.
You didn't
That's
hear
interesting.
Randy.
Interesting. Yeah. He also didn't go to the court that much, right? He was probably there half the time to a third.
He was not.
He wasn't there at the sentence, the verdict read, or the sentencing is what I most noted. Mm-hmm. And you know who I also noted was the Brandstetters weren't there.
Right. Yeah, and that was a question we got, we can also speculate that, but just before we go to that, but before we go to that, your thoughts on Randy and him.
Well, what I thought was so powerful, what Nick was able to report on, was that he said that, his brother said to him, "I'm never going to lie again. I'm never lying again to you. This is it." And then he turned around and he lied. Like he said, within days.
Maybe the next
he
day.
Said, "I'll never lie to you again." This is during that Labor Day roadside shooting. Right. And then he turned around and lies about how he got shot on the side of the road and someone was after him. So I think his credibility with his brother, by the reporting, by the way that story was told, and I don't know how out of context it is, but that I would assume that would be a very strong reason why Alec's credibility went out the window at that point. Or at least Randy, especially since he's suing his brother, right? Mm-hmm. Randy's got to sue him to get his. He's got to be in line to get that money.
Yeah.
There's just a lot of, a lot of places where he just needs to stay very clear for his family, and as sad as I think it is for the entire Murdoch family to go through this, I think Randy, especially as a law partner, must feel.
Well, yeah, I actually really respected. I thought his much more nuanced comments to the New York Times reporter was spot on. Versus that press conference where it was represented that the family became more convinced than ever that he was innocent.
And I'm like,
was that in the same courtroom for 6 weeks? I thought the way Randy phrased it, he had respect for the jury verdict. He still had questions. He wasn't saying he was completely sure his brother was guilty of murder, but he was more nuanced. I thought that was an appropriate tone given the evidence I saw. By the way, I should mention on appeal, too, just to add this other ground beside the harmless error, they're also going to argue very forcefully that the defense waived it by going down these different paths on the financial crime. So if we're still around, I'd like to cover that one, because that you can go to court in Columbia, there's Supreme Court, and hear the arguments back and forth. It'll be live streamed, I'm sure, but that'll be a really good argument.
But tell me what
it's a Supreme Court argument. I would think they would take this one, and you know, we can go Court of Appeals, and then U.S. Supreme, then State Supreme Court. I don't know the different rules on like how you jump to the Supreme Court, but I think eventually our Supreme Court, it has the evidentiary questions are too there. I mean, they're just really, and it did result, I think, in certainly a possibility of why he was convicted. So I think at some point in time, we're going to have televised oral arguments, whoever's representing him on appeal, and whoever's got the state appeal, and that should be fascinating someday. And the Court of Appeals might hear it, then goes to the state Supreme Court. I think that is also maybe the existing rules. I'm not quite sure about that. But my point is, this case is not over.
Right. Charlie, what, I saw this question specifically. Can you speak at all, I'm sure you don't have the statistics off the top of your head, maybe you do, but what percentage of, I guess in your experience, of not just capital cases, but I guess murder cases in general, what is the, I guess, success rate on appeal?
Low.
They're all going to get appealed.
Low.
I can say that without reservation, because typically the proof, the actual cases that go to trial for murder, you know, the state decides who to prosecute, right? And so they typically will have very strong cases that are, and so if you're sitting in the, we have great appellate lawyers on the indigent side, and so they do a great job. And so they get convicted, they're going to take their appeal and do their best they can with it. Now, having said that, the circumstantial evidence cases often, or they have evidentiary questions, you will get these Court of Appeals / Supreme Court opinions that are quite interesting. And so those do get sort of highlighted, but your run-of-the-mill murder case, it doesn't result in much on the appellate side. It just doesn't, other than the fact that, and I should mention this too, you know, you have the direct appeal to the state Supreme Court. They will try and get on the federal side. Usually that goes nowhere. But the other thing that does happen, if you're sitting in a jailhouse cell after your appeals are denied on direct, you have 1 year to file what's called post-conviction relief.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that will be very interesting. See, if he gets affirmed on appeal, does Alex claim that he had ineffective representation by Dick and Jim? That is often...
Well, and we've seen it many, many times, mm-hmm, with really brilliant lawyers. Mm-hmm. I've heard this before. We've mm-hmm seen it before, so it wouldn't be mm-hmm completely out mm-hmm of the range. We have a little bit of time left.
Right.
So I wanted to just get to maybe the heart of anything that you guys wanted to touch on. I did want to bring up when you were talking about Chief Justice Beatty overseeing, he's our South Carolina Supreme Court head mm-hmm justice.
Chief Justice. Uh-huh.
He is the one that appointed Clifton Newman.
Fan club continues.
Fan club.
Brilliant appointment, my personal opinion.
So there's no conflict of interest for them to hear the appeal based on fact that that's his judge that he appointed.
No.
Okay.
No, because he's got to, all circuit judges are assigned, and all these bigger cases they do assign. Never say never. It's possible to bring that. I haven't heard that one as a ground yet.
Well, and also the fact that Judge Newman is, I think he's looking towards retirement. I could be wrong.
My understanding, he's got to retire at age 72.
Right. So how does he get through 99 crimes?
So he is able. You are able to continue to hold court as a retired judge. So I'm assuming they'll let him do that.
I've got a couple minutes left.
Perry Buckner told me he mm-hmm tried a case back mm-hmm in July of last year. Mm-hmm. He said
Circuit Judge Colleton, yeah.
Yeah, and he told me it was on his mm-hmm case roster before he retired, so he had to see it. So they called him back to see it through. Okay, is that generally?
Yeah.
Once it's assigned mm-hmm to you, unless
it's yours,
yeah.
Right.
So I think Judge Newman is probably here for the long haul. One thing that we very, momentarily touched on was the fact that we did, that people wanted to know about, was that we didn't see anyone from the Brandstetter family, anyone from Maggie's family.
Yeah, and I should mention this too. I think this is worthy of discussion as to why this wasn't a capital case. Well, you know, your typical capital case, I've been there many a time, you have family members really pushing for prosecution and wanting justice, and that did not exist in this case, did it? The family members that were there wanted a not guilty verdict. And the proctors did show up briefly, but they weren't sitting there. And so it does, you were there. It creates an ambience in that courtroom. So jurors look around. So if there's no family members, I think it would have made it more difficult, even though I think it was not pushed because of the circumstantial proof issues that could have resulted. So as to why they weren't there, and I think they also didn't fill out a victim, I could be wrong about this, but I thought I heard they didn't fill out a victim impact statement.
That's what I heard too.
So they were out of the victim world. They were there subpoenaed to testify that she did her duty. I thought she came across very credibly, but I'm assuming there's just this desire to keep a relationship with Buster and maybe not get crossways with the Murdochs.
Right.
I don't know that. I'm speculating, but their family, and you know, remember the testimony was that Alex lived with them for like months, right?
Yeah.
After the murders.
So this was a very, very painful.
So it must have been just so painful. And I will say it didn't make a difference in sentencing. I did think that was a double life consecutive sentence that was coming regardless. So you didn't really need that oomph there. The proof of the crime itself provided that. So it may have been appropriate for them not to be there, but it's highly unusual. Highly unusual.
Well, I hate to say this, but we have to go. We are going to have to run at this point. And is there, yes, we do have to go. Shoot, I could talk a lot longer to you guys about what's going on here. We have more to do. We have a lot more to do. We've got a lot more people to talk to. And we're going to be bringing you clips of those interviews. And we'll be able to discuss that as well as sort of looking ahead to what 99 crimes.
Wow.
There's a lot there.
99 crimes.
So it'll be interesting to hear what a few of these attorneys are going to have to say very soon. Thank you for joining us for yet another live recap of the Murdoch trial, sort of in the aftermath of this whole thing. And we've got a lot more to parse out for you. So thank you so much on behalf of myself, Charlie Condon, Drew Tripp, Max Harrison, and Sam Griswold over there, making sure we're doing everything right here. So thanks so much.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.